Welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Tao Leader podcast. This podcast applies a scientific viewpoint on the strange and bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this episode, we speak with James Kent, who is the author of Psychedelic Information Theory, otherwise known as PIT. In this episode, we speak to him about psychedelics, the positives and negatives of psychedelics, as well as some of the most recent studies done on psychedelics and therapy. If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo and like to learn more about James Kent and his work, you can visit our website at taleeaters.com/CE podcast, and there you can click on links that will take you to James Kent's work as well as his book. Additionally, if you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so through our Patreon page, located at the same website. Well, without further ado, let's get to the interview. So James, can you give us a little bit of background about yourself and how you got interested in psychedelics as well as the information or the psychedelic information theory?
Sure. Well, as a child, I was always interested in optical illusions and how perception can be fooled. And I was also a very imaginative child, and I was into things like lucid dreaming and hypnotic states before I even knew what those things were. Like as early as maybe 5 or 6, I was self experimenting with lucid dreaming and hypnotic states, and never really knew anything about drugs or psychedelics until I got to college and was a college student. And my first exposure was with LSD. And the main reason I was interested in LSD is because I had been doing some reading on illusions and hallucination and was really fascinated by the fact that there was this drug that could produce waking dreams. And I kind of wanted to figure out what that was all about. The other thing that really fascinated me about it was that nobody seemed to know how it worked. Right, all of the literature that I was reading back in 1988 or 89 was, you know, Tim Leary and Don Lilly and some of these early psychedelic explorers that would talk in really colorful language about what happened, all of the different experiences that you could have. But whenever it got to the point about how it worked, it would always be, oh, it's a mystery. It's, you know, the human brain is too complex to understand. Or it would be this other thing where, well, maybe something mystical is happening. Maybe something spiritual is happening. There's all these, you know, traditional people, tribal peoples who use this as a sacrament to contact the spirit world. That was all really fascinating to me. So I came at it not from like a lot of my friends and a lot of people that I knew, not as like a recreational thing where it was like, oh, let's get high to, you know, have fun and go freak out and do stuff. I did my share of that. But originally, it was just pure curiosity. It was pure curiosity. How could this exist? How come I didn't know that this exists? And how come everybody I talk to about this has no idea how it works? Those were really the fascinating questions for me. And I remember after the first time I took LSD, and I had some hallucinations. I had some pretty interesting experiences. It wasn't a huge dose of LSD, but it was enough for me to figure out, oh yeah, there's something interesting going on here. I remember maybe the next day or 2 days later thinking to myself, you know, I'm a smart guy. If I spend enough time studying this, I think I can figure this out. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got involved in this scene. And that led me to, this is before the internet, of course, early 90s. That led me to track down a magazine called Psychedelic Illuminations. I met the publisher and I began being the editor-in-chief of that magazine. Because they needed help and I had layout and editorial skills. And then when that magazine folded and I moved to Seattle, I started another magazine called Trip Magazine, which basically took a lot of the subscribers from Psychedelic Illuminations and folded them into the new magazine that I was publishing myself with the help of some friends. And after Trip Magazine, there was a couple years of hiatus, and then I started a web blog, Dose Nation. And this was all as sort of a pretext for me to figure out how to meet people in the community and one, find access to new drugs that I wanted to experiment with, and two, find people who could tell me how it worked, because that was really what I was most interested in. And then after Dose Nation collapsed in around 2005 or 2006, I began really earnestly writing about everything that I had learned. And over a period of maybe 4 years, I went through three or four different versions of Pit until I settled on the version that I actually released. And that's kind of the story in a nutshell. And when I released Pit, I realized that it was probably premature because a lot of the stuff that I was talking about hadn't made it through experimental testing yet. It was a lot of testing that I did on myself or, anecdotal reports that I got from friends. But I published it knowing that if I'm right, within, 10 or 15 years, the research will come out to show, that what I'm saying is fairly accurate because it was the best model that I could come up with, and it was the one that made the most sense. So that's how Pit came together
eventually. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I've read through Pit and tried to understand as much as I possibly could. There's some complex information in there. And I know we've had you on before talking about the actual theory, and you explained very well what's inside of it, but can you give us a brief yeah. overview of what it's about?
The capsule summary is that what I eventually came to understand was that psychedelics and all hallucinogens have to interrupt your perception in a way that fools your brain into thinking that you're dreaming. And they can do that in different ways. The way that psychedelics do that is by disrupting this one pathway, the serotonin 5-HT2A pathway, along with other pathways like the 2C pathways and dopamine pathways and some adrenal pathways. But the tryptamine psychedelics like DMT and psilocybin and LSD, which is actually an ergolamine, but it hits the same receptors as the tryptamines, they all act as partial agonists on this one receptor site, which is really important for binding sensation across the cortex. So making sure that sound and vision and symbolic representations of sound and vision all hit the prefrontal cortex at the same time so we get a clear picture of reality. There's a lot of, fine timing and binding going on there and sensation, so that within a period of about 30 to 60 milliseconds, what we see and hear trickles through our brain and bubbles up as our representational perception. Psychedelics interfere with the subcortical neurons, the pyramidal neurons at the bottom layer of the basal of the cortex, and cause them to start misfiring. So they lose connection with one another. And that causes the brain to kind of lose power and the sections of the brain to disconnect from each other and reconfigure in what I call these novel configurations. And so we get not only noise entering the system, like sounds, like you're not sure where sounds are coming from, or you hear sounds and white noise, mm-hmm. or you get like sort of geometrical visuals in your eyes. That's kind of noise in the system, and you can generate noise in the system in a variety of ways. Like if you make a loud noise next to your ears will start ringing, right? That's the hallucination of like a trauma that's hit the nerves. Hmm. If you get knocked in the head or press on your eyeballs really hard, you'll see stars. That's an indication of noise entering the system through a disruption of the nerve communication. Hmm. So I was looking into how the molecular interaction at certain receptors, one, creates noise in the brain, and two, allows that noise to feedback or echo through the brain. So it creates these sort of layers or echoes of incoming noise and decaying noise that kind of overlap over each other, which create these complex kind of fractal patterns. And that's the core of Pit. Is sort of unpacking all of those ideas. How does the receptor interaction disrupt perception? How is noise created in the system? And then how does that noise feed back on itself to create these complex patterns? That's it in a nutshell. And you can take that same metaphor and apply it to any drug that disrupts perception to create hallucination.
Interesting. Yeah. I remember when I read it, and then I talked to you about Pitt. There was a time where people thought that hallucinations came from outside. They were something that you would experience from, say, like outside of the body, and it was coming in.
I run into those people a lot. Into a spirit world, or they think that they're seeing some electromagnetic radiation, or they're seeing some field, or the force, the cosmic force. There are still plenty of people out there who believe that.
Yeah, but the science is showing it. They're kind of supporting you, saying like it's actually an internal thing. And I'm in like spiritual classes and stuff like that in the community a lot, and a lot of people's dialogue because of this information started to change. It started to shift to be more directed from internal experiences. They're saying you go in and then you experience out, kind of thing. So it kind of seemed like it was supporting a lot of what you're saying. But I mean, when you released this information, there was a lot of feedback and a lot of backlash from people, I think, and from outside of those that supported you. What was your take on that?
Well, there's a historical thing that happened, which was when psychedelics were first discovered by Western science, Western civilization in the early 20s through the middle of the 20th century. Nobody questioned that this was an internal phenomenon. Everybody understood that this was kind of a chemically generated psychosis, like a dream that's activating in your mind, which is why it got moved into the field of psychotherapy. This is a psychotherapeutic drug, right? Because we're going to be looking into the internal mechanics of the way you think. It was only after psychedelics became legal that science stopped talking about it, and all of the information about psychedelics was coming from sort of new age crackpot types, like Terence McKenna, because he's the most popular. And Terence McKenna made his reputation by asserting that, you know, these spirit models that traditional people use for contacting the spirit realm or crossing the veil between life and death, those are legitimate. Those are legitimate, and we should look into those because that's what's ultimately going to save humanity from its downfall. I mean, it had all of these huge overreaching undertones of, you know, this is Armageddon that we're facing. And the only way we can undo the damage that we've done is by reconnecting with the spiritual and harmonizing. And you still hear that. You still hear that line in almost every blend of psychedelic research, including modern psychedelic research. You know, I see a new article that comes out every week that says, "Will psychedelics revolutionize mental health? Will psychedelics cure depression? Are psychedelics the panacea for the modern human condition?" And it's all the same kind of stuff, over and over and over again. I tend to have a much less hysterical and much more realistic view of what's going on. I like to think of it in terms of, just sort of freaking with your own mind, playing with your own mind. I don't really try to. By the time I made it out of the psychedelic scene, I call it by the end of when I finished Dose Nation, I had kind of gone through all of those spiritual metaphors, and I had messed with things like spirit channeling and doing ayahuasca rituals and trying to contact the spirit. And all of that stuff was just it didn't work for me. I mean, I didn't feel like I was progressing as an individual or learning anything by trying to tune into some sort of spirit world or harmonic cosmic power. That just left me with more questions than answers. It was only when I turned to neuroscience and started going back to this, this is an eternal thing. This is more like a dream than it is like a spiritual experience, that I really began to understand what was going on. And there has been some pushback. There has been a little bit of pushback. I had a debate recently with James Gesso and Julian Palmer. I don't know if anyone saw that, but Julian Palmer, after I wrote an article called The Case Against DMT Elves, which I think I wrote in like 2006 when I just got fed up with everybody talking about elves, Rick Strassman's DMT and Terence McKenna's DMT experiments. And I was just like, everyone's focusing on the wrong thing. Let's get rid of this idea that elves are autonomous entities, or that the stuff that you're seeing are autonomous entities, and let's get back to real neuroscience, because that's where we're going to find answers. And people like Julian Palmer didn't like that. And he put on his website like a point by point rebuttal to that article, maybe years after I had written it. James Gesso saw that, had us have a conversation, and we did a debate. And I feel like, you know, my side of the debate is really strong because I've got science and you know, experimental science and scanning that I can point to that sort of points that this is the correct answer. And the spirit models are basically just like, well, you have to trust primitive people that they know what they're doing. And it's like, well, no, I don't trust primitive people that they know what they're doing. Right. I mean, I appreciate their culture. I think it's a beautiful, magical culture, but I'm not going to take that as truth. So that's basically where we are with that community. And it's not like I've been blackballed, but I've definitely told certain people that have like certain publications that are more on the shamanic side that I'm not interested in writing for you because I don't like the information that you're promoting. I think it's misleading in some ways and ultimately dangerous in other ways.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of danger can come from that because people will take it as truth and then they'll just accept it versus actually diving into the science behind it. There's a lot of bad information in communities that I read about, especially when it comes to ayahuasca and things like that, where people are getting taken advantage of. So I think it's important to understand science and understand it for yourself, you know, actually do the research yourself before you start getting involved into some complicated and sometimes dangerous hallucinogens that can really change who you are, you know, just because some shaman said, oh, it's safe and it'll work for you, you know. Psychedelics don't save depression for everyone, you know, it doesn't fix everything.
And that's problematic too when you say read the research for yourself, because since psychedelics have been, you know, prohibited, there's not a whole lot of research that's available to a layperson who's not familiar with neuroscience or biochemistry or psychopharmacology. All of the stuff that you're going to find on the bookshelf is from places like Inner Tradition that are constantly putting out these weird woo-woo stuff about, you know, ancient mystical rituals and returning to the primitive. And that's kind of like their whole thing. It's like all of the answers are returning to the primitive. And people can go through the library of Terrence McKenna and other authors and think that they're doing the research.
Yeah.
When they're not actually doing research, they're actually indoctrinating themselves into a kind of mythology.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And then they all come back to this one central myth. And this is one thing that I've really sort of honed in on in the last few years. The one central myth is that all mystical rituals and spiritual practice and meditation and trance and hallucinogenic drugs, all of these things are all methods to get you to the same mind state, the same central mind state, which is this enlightened connection to the universe, right? This transcendent, transpersonal space. All of the history of mythology and religion and spiritual practice and every spiritual discipline in the world, they're all leading you to the same place. And if you could just take psychedelics to shortcut all of that stuff, to get to that same space, then you're saving yourself a lot of time. You're cutting out a lot of the clutter and you get right to the central space and you're being spiritual by taking a drug. And if spiritual is good, because it teaches it how to be better people, it gives us wisdom, it gives us rules for living, whatever, you know, spiritualism is good. Therefore, taking drugs to alter my mind is good because I'm being spiritual. That's the central myth. That's the central myth that has been promoted, that all drugs take you to the same spiritual center, which I completely reject. I don't think you're going to get to the same space meditating in a Buddhist monastery that you're going to get when you take mushrooms, for instance. You're not going to get the same space trance dancing sober that you're going to get on weed or on ketamine or any one of these drugs. They all cause slightly different mind states, which sometimes can be perceived as spiritual, but that's only one like tiny little fraction of what you're getting in those experiences. So this really disingenuous convolution. I call it like a deliberate confusion between real spiritual practice, which is about self-control and mindfulness, and this weird altered state spiritual practice, which is about how crazy can I make my mind go.
Yeah.
Right? And they're not the same place. The central myth is a lot. These places all lead you to different mind states. There is no one central, pure, transcendent mind state that we're all trying to get to. I think that just needs to be left by the wayside. And I hear that repeated over and over and over and over again.
Just from I hadn't read the book, but before this interview, I had looked at some of the seminars and information you put out. And it's very interesting to see like a systems engineering mind approach to the system of a brain, and a lot of the things I've experienced anecdotally in my own experience, it does seem to me like different mind states, and I always get a little bit it hits me wrong whenever somebody says, you know, these are all going to the same place. I'm like, no, they're the experience of a lot of different things. The experience of meditating is a different experience than what you had, and it's good to see that people are, you know, putting that message out there as opposed to the overwhelming message of transhumanism.
I find it really funny, the grandiosity of the statement that all of these mystical practices are leading to the same space, because you would legitimately have to be a master Buddhist who has achieved enlightenment and somebody who has taken, you know, 500 micrograms of LSD to be able to say, oh yeah, this is the same state. This is the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So there are really no people on the planet who can make that claim realistically, saying that, oh yeah, I've tried every drug, I've tried every spiritual practice, they all lead me back to the same place, so whatever, one's no better than the other. You know, there is nobody on the planet like that, mm-hmm. who has like who can legitimately say, oh yeah, I've achieved both enlightenment and gotten really high on LSD and they're both the same thing.
I mean, there's no way to quantify it.
Yeah, it's just a silly statement, but people are like, oh yeah. And I think it was Aldous Huxley in his he gave a speech called The Visionary Experience back in 1967, or The Visionary State or The Visionary Experience. And he makes this, I mean, this is the central point of his philosophy, that all of these mystical practices are leading to the visionary state. And the visionary state is the jewel of human consciousness. It's the jewel of human consciousness that everybody's mining for in all of these different ways. And that's a really powerful idea, that the visionary state is this jewel that people will, they'll fast, they'll do all sorts of deprivation exercises, they'll flog themselves, they'll drug themselves with intoxicants, you know, to near death, just to get that visionary state. And I agree that the visionary state is something like a jewel of human consciousness, but it's not as valuable as everybody makes it out to be. It's more of like a sideshow, I think, than a pinnacle.
Hmm. I mean, and I guess why do you think that? Why is the visionary state not as important as some other state, I guess?
Because ultimately it's an accident, right? I mean, you don't naturally stumble into a visionary state. Like if you have a problem, your car breaks down on the side of the road, it has a flat tire, you think to yourself, oh, well, that tire needs to be swapped out with a new tire. That's about as far as the visionary state needs to go, right? You need to visualize a solution and then come back and implement that solution. So the visionary state has practical implications for living your life. But there's no reason to be on your back in the visionary state for, you know, 3 or 4 hours under the influence of mushrooms. The amount of information that's going to pour through your head in that time, you're not going to be able to capture. It's a recreational activity. It's not a spiritual activity. I mean, you can come out of it changed, of course. There's all sorts of evidence that shows that psychedelics cause change in thought and change in behavior and change in personality. But that's not the same as saying, the visionary experiences pinnacle. That's just saying that people who suffer profound or experience profound visionary experiences sometimes change their lives because they have something akin to a post-traumatic stress disorder that forces them to change things that they thought were true before in the wake of this heavy experience. And that's another thing that I'm really closely looking at, is how psychedelics actually cause brain change and behavior change and personality change. Because that does have practical application more than whatever the content of the specific vision was. The content of the specific vision is fleeting, and then it disappears. So that's why I feel like it doesn't really have a whole lot of value, other than it's just fun. It's just fun to experience, you know. It's just like, holy cow, what is going on? But the thing that is valuable is how the change that happens afterwards. And if that's not happening in some sort of controlled setting, the change could be really detrimental. It can be really detrimental, or it could be really valuable, depending on how that integration is managed post visionary experience. So it's really, the value is in the intent and the follow up and the integration. The visions itself are sort of, like I said, they're sort of like this, like the scenery that you pass on the road along the way. Once they come through, they're gone, and then and then they're done. I mean, what good is that? You can make a painting of it, maybe, that comes close to what you saw, or you can make some trippy house music that sounds like something that you heard. And all of that stuff is great. I mean, I love all that stuff. I love hallucinogenic art and psychedelic music and all that stuff. I think that's great. I mean, that's part of the culture, but it's not. I wouldn't call it the jewel of humanity.
Right.
It's, you know, it's fun. It's like a fun. It's you know, that, and if fun is, if you're a hedonist and fun is your highest calling, then yeah, maybe this is the jewel of human experience, because you know, it's better than heroin for sure.
Definitely. Well, I mean, you know, cross-culturally, shamans have been part of cultures for, you know, as long as human history has ever existed, as far as we know. So, I mean, there's something there to it for having this reason of at least one person in a tribal setting to have visionary states of some kind and be able to help people and heal people. But, you don't have the whole tribe sitting there generally taking hallucinogens. But, I mean, would you, in that perspective, would you say that there is some use to having these visionary states or, you know, quote unquote, spiritual experience, at least by one person in the group, to bring some type of interesting elements to the tribe?
Yeah. So this is kind of the area where I think Terence McKenna really had his strongest arguments about shamanism, is that you need to have somebody going ahead of the pack. You need to have somebody doing recon out into the future. And looking into the distance and then reporting back to people what you found. And I think in a lot of ways, the shaman fills that role of, you know, what does the future hold? Well, you know, what's going to happen to us? Is this sickness going to be deadly, or are we going to recover from it? All of these things, the shaman, you know, tries to look to the future and tries to figure out what's going on. And I think in a lot of ways, the role of the shaman has been decentralized and segmented out to, you know, like scientists and you know, futurists, technological people that do trend forecasting and stuff like that. So the core of the visionary ritual the air has been sucked out of it. Like, it's not that magical anymore, because very rarely do you get somebody who takes mushrooms or LSD and comes back saying, "Oh, I know exactly what's going to happen next year." Yeah. Terence McKenna, you know, a spectacular failure. He said 2012, the world's going to end. I had the vision. I know what's going on in the future. Turns out not correct. And that's the thing with most psychedelic premonition, is that it is not correct. I mean, it feels genuine at the time. Like, you may feel like, "Oh, I'm communing with nature and I'm touching the harmonic greatness," but that is hallucination. I mean, it's, you're not touching anything. It's all sort of a game you're playing with yourself. The one thing I will say is that psychedelics have an extreme power to bond tribal groups together. And you see this in the psychedelic community over and over again. Very rarely do you get like a lone wolf tripper like me. I kind of view myself as a lone wolf tripper, even though I was like, went to Grateful Dead shows and I liked the scene. I never liked being in a group setting on drugs because I didn't trust the other people around me. I felt, always felt like somebody's going to lose it.
We're going to be baiting that
person, or I'm getting weird vibes from that person. So, you know, personally, I'm not really a group guy. I tend to keep to myself. So I sort of look at myself as a lone tripper. But what I have seen over and over again in every generation that comes up, whether it's the hippie generation, the Grateful Dead generation, the rave generation, whatever's going on now, these groups, these tribal groups sort of spontaneously get together, like the Burning Man group. And it's not always just like a bunch of young kids throwing a rave. There's young kids, there's old people, there's people from all over the world, and they're all sort of coalescing around this group tribal idea. And there's always this recurring idea of we're gonna create a commune somewhere.
We
all just get away and have this funky little community where we all just hang out and trip and have free love, and we're just gonna leave the modern world behind. And that's like an ongoing delusion of these psychedelic tribes, and that's usually when they start to burn out, because you can't sustain that forever. You can't sustain that communal dropout setting forever. Eventually, people start to get on each other's nerves, and they realize that it's work keeping together a community in a small tribal population, and nobody wants to do the work, and then it falls apart. And you can track these little communities over and over again. But I find it really interesting that there is this spontaneous bonding and group dynamic that happens around these drugs that doesn't happen, say, around or even pot. I mean, there's a lot of people who are pot enthusiasts who hang out with other people who smoke pot, but they very rarely say, oh, we're going to go start a pot commune where everybody smokes pot all day. That is a purely psychedelic idea. That's a purely psychedelic idea. No other drug does that, and no other like philosophy does that either. I mean, it's so weird that a lot of these psychedelic experimentations and these psychedelic groups and intentional communities, they all want to move towards this neo-primitivism of like dropping out and forming our own society where we grow our own vegetables and eat raw food or whatever it is. They all have their own flavor of what they want to do. But it's essentially, we want to return to the primitive. And that's a really fascinating thing that I'm not exactly sure what's going on there. But it is something that I keep studying. And of course, the other thing is using psychedelics in therapy, which I think is valuable. I think it is. Yes. I think it is a valuable tool to use in therapy. I don't think it's going to revolutionize mental health or be a panacea for anxiety and PTSD and depression. I think for some people, they'll react very well and they'll have positive change. Other people will not like it, and it might make them worse. But the trials need to be done. I feel like the experimentation the trials need to be done. The clinical work needs to be done to see where that therapy works, how to target it, what the protocol that you use is, and what the best follow-up is to make sure that whatever change that you're imposing, whether it's don't be so depressed, don't be so anxious, quit smoking, stop being obsessive compulsive, stop overeating, all of these things, you may be able to fine-tune behavior with psychedelics, but I think we're still just at the very beginning of that. I'm not sure it's going to be like a medical revolution. I just feel like it's another tool in the toolkit that can be used.
Well, there's a lot of dark experiences that happen with psychedelics too. I mean, when I first started using or trying ayahuasca, for instance, had some traumatic experiences through that, through the visions and things that I saw that really impacted my life negatively for a long period of time. And I had to work through that. But I would say that it caused me some anxiety, didn't make it go away, that's for sure, you know. So I know that you have been kind of focusing on the dark side of psychedelics as well, and I'd like to hear some of that so we can tell people about those things.
Yeah, so I appreciate that story, because I get a lot of people who contact me over email saying, I had some ayahuasca experience and ayahuasca ceremonies, and I think I have PTSD now. I think I have a lingering anxiety disorder that I contracted, and it's usually not that self-aware. It's usually I took ayahuasca and I feel like I messed myself up and something's wrong now. That's the kind of thing I get. Or weirdly, on the other end of it, I feel like the shaman that I was working with put a curse on me.
Now
the spirit entity living in me, giving me these bad visions or the anxiety. And I definitely
had that same kind of feeling where through the use of ayahuasca and because of me reading a lot of books on shamanism that somehow, you know, I contracted something by doing something wrong, you know, I wasn't in a ceremony type situation. I wasn't blessed, things like that. So it was like, I did something wrong here that caused this to happen. How do I fix it now? You know?
Yeah. That's a common condition is people blame themselves. They think I did something wrong because I read in this book that this is supposed to be a magical, wonderful healing experience. But I feel like I've been violated. I feel like I've been assaulted somehow, and I don't know how to communicate that. And to be honest, people who contact me, I'm usually not their first source of contact. They contact other people in the community who are maybe a little bit more famous than I am. Mm-hmm. And they send me the responses that these people give them. And I'm sometimes floored because these people blame them too. They say, maybe you were doing it wrong. Maybe you had a bad experience because you ate the wrong thing or you didn't perform the ceremony the wrong way or you took too much or, you know, there's always an excuse for why the drug didn't work as advertised when it's supposed to be this magical spiritual experience. There's always an excuse. You did something wrong. It wasn't the shaman. It wasn't the drug. It was you. So figure out what is wrong with you. Don't tell me that something's wrong with ayahuasca. And it's so frustrating when I hear the same story over and over and over again from people who have had, one, they've had a horrific traumatic experience on a psychedelic. Yeah. Okay. They've intentionally poisoned themselves and had some sort of toxic response that left them feeling wounded in some way or traumatized in some way. And then when they go to support, they go to get mental health support from the community, they say, oh, it must be you. Maybe you have a pre-existing psychotic condition that you didn't know about. So don't blame the ayahuasca. It's you. You didn't do enough research or whatever. It's your problem. And I think that has to stop. That has to stop immediately. And I've been working sort of informally with Ingmar Gorman. Peter Gorman is a different guy in Peru who does ayahuasca ceremonies. But Ingmar Gorman is a psychologist in New York who started this thing called the Psychedelic Program, dealing with people specifically who have anxiety disorders related to fallout from traumatic psychedelic episodes. Mm. So I refer a lot of people to him, but he can really only treat people in the New York area. We're trying to find a bigger network of certified professionals that people can work with. And when people contact me, I kind of try to do some legwork to find people in their area who can help them. But sadly, a lot of the time, these people don't have health insurance and they don't have a lot of money and they don't have access to good health care. So they're stuck with people like me, like amateurs who know a lot about this because I took the risk to do illegal stuff. Right? There's not a lot of legitimate practitioners out there who have the kind of experience that I do because I did everything that I did illegally, knowing that I would never have an academic credential or an academic degree or hold any teaching position anywhere because I've done so much underground research. I'm just, you know, I'm not credible. I'm not credible because essentially I'm a criminal. I was doing criminal research for 20 plus years. And yet I'm still one of the primary sources of contact for people who are suffering from these unforeseen fallout experiences. And I don't talk about the people that contact me on the Dose Nation podcast. I'm doing this series called The Last 10 Episodes on Dose Nation that I've been working on for the last 10 years. I'm up to episode 8. But I talk about popular people historically in the community who have publicly spiraled out into these crazy delusions and these crazy delusional states, talking about doing everything from, you know, killing themselves, you know, running away in the middle of the night and dying from exposure, to convincing yourself that drilling a hole in your head is the way to achieve, you know, whatever it is, mystical union. And there are people in the psychedelic community who have holes in their head because they legitimately thought that this was the way to cure mental illness. Fortunately, that fad passed, but those people are still around and they're still in the community and they're still giving advice to people. So it's like it's an ongoing problem. Psychedelics can mess you up. I mean, they can mess you up if you don't have like a good sense of what's going on in reality.
Well, maybe that's why people are linking out to talk to you, because they want to talk to somebody that's rational, that has kind of been against the norm, you know, and you've been doing like research and actually like real research on the subject before it was legal to do research. So definitely been forefront of that type of action. So that's probably why people are doing that, why they correspond with you directly.
And I find it weird that there are not more rational people in the psychedelic community. I mean, of course, Ingmar Gorman, he's a psychologist. He's got a degree. He's trained. He's got a career. He has to be rational. And the people in academia, they present rationally a lot of the times because, you know, they have to keep their academic degrees. They have to keep their profiles up. But even then, sometimes these PhDs, these academics, when you talk to them in person, they have really weird ideas about what's going on. I mean, in psychedelics, and I don't want to name names of people who are still out there practicing, but I find it with almost everybody in the psychedelic community that there is this sort of fringe of irrationality where they either believe that something mystical is going on, they believe psychedelics are completely harmless. I hear that over and over from academics. Oh, psychedelics are harmless. They should be legal. And I'm like, okay, well, just because you don't die or show up in the emergency room doesn't mean they're harmless. They can cause some serious emotional damage and mental damage. So I feel like I'm one of the lone voices out there that's saying that, because so much of the psychedelic community is focused on re-legitimizing psychedelics for clinical use and medicine. And all of the people involved in that, from MAPS to everybody in academia who wants to do these studies, they have to act like lobbyists now. Like NRA lobbyists. When somebody goes on a shooting rampage, the NRA says, guns aren't bad. That was a bad person. Mm-hmm. That was a bad person with a gun. And I see the same thing happening in the psychedelic community now. When somebody has a bad trip or goes and does something heinous and completely unimaginable on psychedelics, they say, oh, well, overall, they're completely safe. That was just one bad person who had a bad trip. And I think that that's just an unfortunate example of where we are in history in terms of psychedelic research. And I wish that they didn't have to be so hewing to that line of psychedelics are harmless. And there could be just a little bit more, like you say, rationality or acceptance of what the real dangers are.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that every person that uses psychedelics, if they continue to do it, they will have a bad trip, and it could be traumatizing for anyone that doesn't have rational thought, that they generally just kind of believe in the mystical ideas, and they believe what they read. They're going to treat those as real experiences that are going to traumatize them long term. They're not going to work through those things. If they can rationalize them, then they can kind of mentally work through it, or they can seek help with people that are trained professional in the mental health community that can actually help them and counsel them back to realize that, you know, these experiences are just a way of our consciousness or subconscious communicating with ourselves, things like that. But I mean, you know, for me myself, I keep a perspective of like of being on a fence rider. You know, I'm one leg in the science community, one leg in the spiritual community, and I tend to see both sides of the argument. But when I first started using hallucinogens, not first, but later on, I started reading like people's work, like Benny Shannon on ayahuasca, and mm-hmm. and additionally your work, because it gave me perspective that I typically wouldn't get from the ayahuasca community or the psychedelic community, where it's one-sided. So personally, I appreciate what you have done, and because it helped me personally overcome some of my anxieties, and it sounds like it's helping other people as well. So I wanted to touch in something else that you talked about, is why some people don't hallucinate. And this is interesting to me because I hallucinate very easily. I don't take a lot of hallucinogens and or substances, and I'm completely gone and seeing things and experiencing all these things. But then I will have friends and people that I know that have described taking massive amounts of psilocybin mushrooms or something like that, and they don't see anything. And so I don't know what the answer is to that. So I would like to know what your thoughts are.
So I don't have a great answer, but I'm trying to work through a lot of different avenues on this, because I do run into people who don't hallucinate. Now, the first thing that I was thinking was that it must be a genetic thing. Some people just genetically, maybe they're not as internally visual as others. They don't really have strong, vivid dreams. They're not prone to hallucination. And therefore, when they take hallucinations, that internal visualization part of their brain is just not up to the task. You know, for whatever reason, they're just not, you know, they're not born with that ability. I'm moving farther and farther away from that genetic idea the more that I go into this. And one thing that I found that was really interesting is that a lot of the people, not 100%, but a very high percentage, maybe 60 or 70% of the people that I talk to who have this, like, yeah, I take big doses of mushrooms, and I've taken ayahuasca, and I don't really have like vivid hallucinations. A lot of those people are vegans or vegetarians, which led me to think, okay, so there's a lot of vegans in the psychedelic community because there's an overlap there between, you know, like the spiritual connection to nature, and I want to be more empathetic to living things, so I don't want to kill animals, and I'm gonna eat vegan now as part of my spiritual journey of becoming a better person. But when you do that, you're chronically not getting enough choline and B vitamins in your diet, which can only be found through like eggs and dairy and meat. And choline and B5 are the minerals that are most commonly associated with vivid dreams. So if you're not getting enough choline in your diet, you start to get things like insomnia, and you stop dreaming, you stop having vivid dreams. And if you're one of those vegans who is suffering from insomnia and not having vivid dreams, I will almost guarantee you that when you take psychedelics, you're not going to have visions, because your internal visualization rendering machine is chronically malnourished. And we had a talk on the last time we did this podcast. I went back and re-listened to it a couple of weeks ago. We talked about the switch between serotonin and acetylcholine that sort of flips between the waking and dreaming brain. And when acetylcholine starts modulating the midbrain, that's when dreams start coming online. That's when these visions start coming online in the dreaming state. And how certain kinds of drugs like hallucinogenics knock back the serotonin modulation and allow the acetylcholine modulation to come forward. Other drugs like Datura, they kick that acetylcholine into overdrive and knock the serotonin away. So you're having these really vivid, more like delusions than hallucinations. So one of the things that I've been looking at is diet may play a big factor in whether or not you hallucinate. And if you are not a meat eater and you don't supplement with B vitamins and choline, you may be having a hallucination problem. Now, another person that I met who didn't hallucinate, who wasn't vegan, was an extremely picky eater and would only eat certain things. Like he would only eat burritos and pizza. And like he had like a very limited palate of things that he would eat. Never ate leafy greens, never ate vegetables, never ate any fruits or stuff like that. Didn't hallucinate. And I was like, okay, well, I'm kind of honing in on this as maybe a dietary thing. And if you change your diet, change the supplements that you're taking,
your dreams will return, your normal sleep will return, and then your ability to help to hallucinate will return. I'm not at the point where I'm willing to, you know, to put this into a scientific paper or even make a casual statement that this is why. But this is what I'm studying right now. And I may actually be doing a wider survey sometime in the next few months or year to figure out if we can identify a bunch of non-hallucinators and figure out what the underlying mechanism is of why these people aren't hallucinating. Ultimately, there may be people who are just genetically predisposed to not hallucinate.
Interesting.
For whatever reason. And there may also be a dietary element. I also feel like people stop hallucinating the older that they get. I feel like your hallucinations are really strong when you're younger, and the older that you get, they're not as strong, or you need to take more substance for them to come. So there may be a defense mechanism in the brain. If you trip a lot throughout your life, like multiple times a year over many years, your brain may build up a defense mechanism that keeps the brain from destabilizing to the point where it starts hallucinating. Because this would be like a defensive mechanism for if you're an animal in the wild and you're out just, you know, eating whatever you can find that looks like a food source. You eat mushrooms, you hallucinate. An animal can't figure out what's in its diet that makes it hallucinate. So internally, its body needs to, if that food keeps coming through the system, if that toxic keeps coming through the system, some sort of neural mechanism will kick into place to form a defense against that. So it doesn't, the most deranging effects of the drug are minimized the longer you keep taking it.
Interesting.
That's another theory that I'm working on. I don't really have any proof for that either. These are just some of the threads that I've been, because literally I never actually had the assumption that there were some people who took psychedelics and didn't hallucinate. They're called hallucinogens. I mean, and I find it really weird that I have to establish the fact that hallucinogens make you hallucinate. And that's one of the things that I would have to do if I ever wanted to publish on this, is I would have to establish the fact that hallucinogens make you hallucinate. Wow. And then establish why they don't make you hallucinate if for some reason, for some people, they don't. So it's a really sort of tricky thing that I'm sort of locked in here before I can really go forward and say, hey, you know, why doesn't it work for me? I don't know why it doesn't work for you, but trust me when I say it works for me and it works for Lee I don't know who else, but there's a lot of, you can look at the psychedelic art and you say, yeah, I know where that comes from. That comes from, you know, the crazy stuff that you see when you're tripping.
So something you said there was interesting is that, you know, the older you get, the less you can kind of trip on psychedelics. And I've also noticed that the older you get, the less people tend to dream. And also an odd thing is that the older you get, the more you hallucinate naturally too. So I've read reports of an old, you know, in housing, like old folks' homes, I guess you could call them, where people, they hallucinate all the time, these old people. They just tend to not really talk about it. So there's some scientific work talking about like the visions they see and stuff like that. And it's pretty common, oddly enough. But I mean, wonder if that has something to do with the calcification of certain areas of the brain, things like that as well. You know, and as you get older, certain parts of your brain do calcify. And I wonder if that's kind of linked into that. So I don't know.
I've been actually studying a couple different threads along these very same lines. And I feel like there's maybe a couple things going on, because there is a kind of hallucination that's only associated with Parkinson's disease, which is a dopamine disorder. And generally older people progressing through Parkinson's disease will start to get these hallucinations. And they're usually more like floating, blurry hallucinations of shapes or people out of the corner of your eye that they get. And when you turn to look at them, they sort of, you know, they float to the corner of your eye when you try to hone in on them. These are very much like the hallucinations people who have Charles Bonnet syndrome have. Do you know, are you familiar with Charles
Bonnet? I'm not familiar with that.
There's a condition that happens when you get macular degeneration in the ocular nerve, and the optic nerve starts to degenerate. The connections between the retina and the nerve start to deteriorate. These people also get hallucinations, free-floating hallucinations, usually in the periphery of the vision. And one of the articles, I mean, the reason that I wrote the case against DMT elves was because there was a guy online, a guy named Clifford Pickover, who's written a lot about hallucination and weird brain stuff. He was trying to compare the hallucinations that people who have Charles Bonnet syndrome have to the hallucinations that people who smoke DMT have. And I just basically had to come in and say, no, 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 these are not the same thing. The hallucinations that people who have macular degeneration have are not swirling, colorful rainbows and you know, tunnels of light and color. They're different. So different forms of neural degeneration having to do with aging will probably form different types of hallucination, yeah, depending on what you have. Like a person with early onset dementia has different hallucinations than a person with, say, Parkinson's disease have. Person with early onset dementia, they'll usually have these flashes where they think that they're somewhere that they're not, right? And they maybe can see where they are, what's going on, but they think that they're somewhere else. And so that there's some disconnection between the reality that they're seeing and the reality that they're parsing in their brain. And that happens maybe through neural degeneration or calcification. I'm not sure. There are also people who get trauma to the medial temporal lobe who can't control hallucinations. And it may have to do with something related to the hippocampus or some area around the hippocampus that's not stopping hallucinations. Like, so when, like I said, we have this thing, it's like, oh, visualize a bird flying from a tree. And you sort of turn off your waking vision and you think in your internal mind, oh, bird flying from a tree. When you're done, you return. Mm-hmm. If the ability to turn off that internal visualization, to just stop it when you're done thinking about that bird, is broken, then suddenly everything that you think is going to have this sort of lasting sticking power in your brain. And so, yeah, there's lots of different ways the brain can start hallucinating in old age. And it's one of the things that as I get older, I'm probably going to study more because I'm going to know more people who are having these problems. I just turned 50. So it's one of the things that I'm looking at now is maybe doing like field research in nursing homes with people who are having hallucinations to sort of talk about.
I think you would learn a ton.
Different types of hallucinations you get from different diagnoses of Alzheimer's, dementia, or Parkinson's, or whatever degenerative disease you have, there's probably a hallucination type that goes along with it.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It surprises me that, I mean, you brought up multiple times that hallucinations are different, you know, based on drugs as well as the areas of the brain that it affects. And it surprises me that you'd have to bring that up. You know, that it's not common knowledge that if you take say psilocybin, you know, you're going to have the same visual effects and things like that as if you took peyote or anything like that. They're totally different. They're affecting different parts of the brains, you know, and it surprises me that you'd have to even talk about that with the community.
Yeah. I mean, it seems self-evident to me that LSD had its own sort of visuals and psilocybin had its own sort of visuals and mescaline had its own sort of visuals. And there's also a difference in quality and intensity of visuals that you get when you say take LSD by itself and then take LSD and maybe an hour into the trip you smoke some marijuana or smoke some hashish. And a lot of psychedelic drug use that happens in the modern underground, very rarely you're just taking mushrooms or you're just taking LSD. A lot of times there's multiple drugs combined. So if I'm being perfectly honest, a lot of my personal experimentation with psychedelics and the hallucinations that I have, it's not just mushrooms hallucinations, it's mushroom and pot, because I would have been smoking weed on top of the mushrooms, especially when, you know, you feel the hallucinations coming on, you take a tiny hit of weed and then boom, you know, suddenly they're just like full blown. Same thing with nitrous oxide. We would used to go to the Grateful Dead show and we would like take acid, and we'd be smoking joints in the parking lot and smoking joints at the show. And then after the show, we'd just huff nitrous oxide, and the hallucinations would just become insane, right? You already have these bubbling layers of hallucinations coming up, and then you take the nitrous oxide, and it's just like,
wow.
Right? It's just this attack of hallucinations that just, you know, hit you like a, you know, just one after the other, like, you know, because nitrous oxide has that sort of throbbing effect. Whom, whom, yeah. Whom, whom, whom. And what I did not talk about in Pitt at all is a lot of times these are multi-drug hallucinations that are like honed through experimentation by trippers to figure out exactly what's going to give me the most bang for my buck. And that's scientific. I mean, that is a scientific thing, but it's very hard to unpack in clinical experimentation or clinical research.
Oh, absolutely. You can't really mix.
And be like, all right, it's been 40 minutes. It's time for your joint. Let's see if that fixes this nation. Well, maybe
it will. Might be a while before we get to that point in our society to be able to mix and match stuff.
Right.
I mean, a lot of research has been coming out. You know, Michael Pollan released his book, and so everyone's on this train of like, oh, you know, like new scientific research. Michael Pollan's making psychedelics. Like, you know, you can change your mind and the world around you, whatever. That's good and all. You know, that brings out a lot of talk and discussion. But I'm wondering, like, I don't know too much about the default mode network, but it from, you know, from reading your book and then my understanding of basic psychology and how neural network works and stuff like that, and as well as the activation synthesis hypothesis from Hobson, I think his name was Alan Hobson, but tying that all together, sounds like your theory actually discussed that, and I talked about it online with a couple of people and they got really defensive and said, they're like, no, your research in the pit actually is totally different. So I'm wondering, can you clarify that for me?
Yeah. So there's been a couple different studies. I think you're talking about the studies done by Robin Carhart Harris, the one who was basically focusing on the default mode network.
That was LSD, right?
LSD. They've done LSD studies and psilocybin studies.
Okay.
I was just reading a paper yesterday called "The Default Mode Network is Disrupted in Parkinson's Disease with Visual Hallucinations." So there is clinical evidence to support that disrupting the default mode network leads to hallucinations. These are not the hallucinations that we're talking about, like when you take ayahuasca or mushrooms, for instance. These are the other sort of peripheral floating object hallucinations.
Oh, yeah, and Parkinson's.
And Parkinson's disease. So what Pitt said before any of this research came out was that psychedelics block what I was calling the control frequency that keeps everything locked to a linear perception, and it allows the brain to decouple and reorganize in spontaneous ways, what I called novel configurations. What Robin Carhart Harris is saying is that psychedelics interfere with the default mode network, creating dynamical brain states with an enhanced repertoire. Now, it's just basically different language saying the same thing. It's saying the same thing, that psychedelics disrupt the resting network that our brain has, and it allows different areas of the brain to reharmonize so that they can cohere with themselves in novel ways that they haven't before, calling it an enhanced repertoire and dynamical states. And that's fine. I mean, because when I wrote this, I knew that this is where the research was going. So there is a chapter in my book, in the early part of the book, where I talk about how consciousness can be splintered, and then the different factions of consciousness, like your perception, your dreaming mind, your memory recall, can spontaneously reorganize so that you're just pushing information straight into perception from memory, as opposed to having to go through these normal channels. And that's essentially what they have doing MRI scanning of people under the influence of psychedelics and psilocybin, or LSD and psilocybin, this is what happens, is the brain, the power levels of the brain, what I call the control frequency, but it's essentially the brain rhythms that keep everything locked together. Their power levels go down and diminish. The blood levels in the brain go down and diminish. And the different areas of the brain break apart and start cohering with each other in new ways. And these sort of harmonic couplings is what it's called, because they start, you know, the power in the PFC goes down. So the visual cortex and the temporal lobe starts communicating with each other really, really fastly, really quickly and robustly. And they found that LSD tends to cause reharmonic couplings at higher frequencies. Psilocybin causes harmonic couplings at slightly lower frequencies. And this is all stuff that basically was predicted in PIT. It's the scanning research that they've done, they've gotten it much clearer. They've gotten evidence. They're showing which parts of the brain are affected, what the effects of power levels are, what the frequency ranges of the spontaneous reorganizations are, what the different types of dynamic repertoires are. All of that stuff is sort of coming together now. But that was the initial assumption that I made in PIT, was that this is what's happening. And when I wrote that, I knew that within, I thought maybe 10 years, the research would come out to show that. It only took about 5 years. And that's, you know, I'm not going to pat myself on the back and say that I'm knowing that. I inferred all that from looking at the EEG scans that had been done up to that point. I was just making my own analysis of the EEG scans that had been done up to that point. I didn't, you know, have some amazing insight on drugs going, oh, my brain is decoupling and reorganizing. No, I was looking at heat maps of EEG readings of people in ayahuasca and saying, oh, I think I get what's going on here. The other thing that has come out just last month in June was a paper in Cell Reports called Psychedelics Promote Structural and Functional Neuroplasticity. And this is one thing I talked about in the chapter of PIT, which was, if psychedelics do cause change in behavior and thought, the only way that they can do that is by causing new neural growth. There is no secret mechanism for changing the way that your brain thinks other than reorganizing your synaptic networks. And this, it was sort of a, I mean, I almost didn't put it in there. It was sort of a bold thing to say that psychedelics promote neural growth. I may have been one of the first people to say that in any book anywhere, even though people may have been speculating about it and so on. I basically came out and said, this is how it works. Psychedelics promote short-term neural growth. And what it's doing is it's doing synaptic modeling and testing the same way that happens in a dream state. What happens when you're dreaming is your middle brain is sort of going through all the patterns that you've been studying during the day and repeating them and testing them to see which ones are strong and which ones can be thrown out. And so certain synapses get strengthened and certain synapses atrophy, depending on, you know, what patterns, what routines you're doing that day. And so my assumption was that psychedelics create this state where you go through this extreme testing and mapping of synaptic states within the brain as almost a toxic response. So you get poisoned and you start hallucinating. And your brain goes into a panic mode where it's like, what happened? What happened? What's going on? How do I fix this? What information have I gotten in the past that will help me get out of this situation? I'm going to test every single memory I have and make sure that I'm not dying. And if I am dying, how do I keep myself from dying? And what does that mean? And it's very much the same kind of thing that people report when they see their life flashing before their eyes, when they're about to die, when they're having these like near-death experiences. Your mind goes into a panic mode and it starts testing memory for patterns that you can use to fix whatever's happening to you right now. It's like an emergency search through your memory for something that's going to help you survive. And that has to just through the mechanics of that synaptic testing, that has to promote neural growth. That was what I was thinking. You can't be having all of these memory testing and all of these visions and all of these sort of new ideas coming together in psychedelic without some kind of new synaptic testing happening. So I was thinking, God, it has to promote synaptic growth. So this research comes out last month that shows not only do psychedelics, LSD and psilocybin, as well as ketamine, not only do they promote microtubule growth, which is the first thing that has to happen. I mean, microtubules are the sort of scaffolding inside the cell that allow dendrites to grow, the branches and synapses to grow. They need to have microtubules. Not only does it cause spontaneous growth of microtubules, it causes spontaneous spinogenesis, which is creation of new branches in dendrites, reaching out to find new synaptic connections. It also revitalizes atrophied dendrites. So dendrites that have been atrophied from lack of use will suddenly come back into use and grow and reconnect to their old synaptic clefts to test those connections again to see if they're relevant. And all of this stuff is just like, it's more than I assumed that it was. I mean, this is like, I thought that maybe there was some moderate growth in testing that happened while the drug was active. What this paper is saying is that no, the testing happens for hours, if not days, after the drug wears off. Because this is a biological process that once it's kickstarted, it lasts for a few days. So in the wake of a psychedelic experience, your brain is still testing new connections. It's still growing new dendrites and new synaptic pathways. Well after the drug has left your system. So I think this is probably one of the most profound papers that I've seen in my lifetime discussing psychedelics, and it just came out last month. Yeah. So if I ever do another version of Pitt and update it, this is definitely going to be a major component of it, because I have a feeling that, I mean, because what I said in Pitt is that if psychedelics do have the power to change your mind, the way that psychedelic therapy works is through neuroplasticity, being able to change the functional organization of the neural connections. Pretty bold statement to make, but knowing what I know about the brain and learning, moving synapses around and moving neural dendrites around, is we do that all day. It's not like a magical thing. It's something that we do all day, every day. It's just that when we dream and when we're hallucinating, this seems to happen really a lot. I mean, it happens, a trophic response that cells go through. Like I said, it's testing and strengthening of synaptic connections for more robust throughput of signal and problem solving. And it's exactly what's happening.
Wow.
So it is a really fascinating paper. And I've read it like two or three times now, and I still can't believe it, because it's like, it's almost too much. I mean, it almost seems like too on the nose for what I was talking about, but it's definitely, that's how they work. I mean, that's how they change brains, is by causing functional growth of atrophied dendrites and new synaptic connections. And that could be how they treat depression. That could be why they work for depression, is because these old atrophied, pathways are now up and functioning again and more robust. So that could have a huge impact on the way that people target therapy, behavioral therapy and behavioral modification, is understanding how fast that neural growth is and how to, they talk a lot about integration in the psychedelic scene. And I think that's really what they're talking about, is how to keep the good connections and lose the bad connections. Because if all you're doing is growing new synaptic connections, that's not good. That's not good, because you need to have some sort of discrimination between, is this information that I want to keep in my head, or is this information that's not good? Because if you go into delusional states where now you think that you're inhabited by a spirit, that's not a good neural connection that you want to keep. Right. You don't want to reinforce that connection with the thought
would not
that
be helpful for depression.
Yeah, you want to integrate that out of there and say, well, that's, what do we learn from that experience? We're going to take those connections as the good ones. Synaptic growth without some kind of protocol for behavior modification or integration is not good all by itself. I mean, it could lead to good results. It could lead to bad results. But so it's not synaptic growth is not a magic bullet. It just needs it just shows how behavioral change works when it works. You know,
that's a really good point, man.
Mm-hmm.
Matt, do you have any questions?
I'm scared I might cause feedback. Oh, I am. I think it's just me.
Sounds like you're good.
Okay. No, I was just I'm just amazed by what I'm hearing. Like this is all brand new to me. Like I think I'm gonna look into it because I had the same assumption going through that, you know, this is all a chemical process. It's what we should be really worried about is where our consciousness, awareness, what we are aware of and how that changes as a result of this experience. And that's what's gonna cause, you know, growth, you know. So yeah, like if actual brain cells are reconnecting and reconfiguring and there's an orchestra of reconfigured ensembles of brain activity, that's great news for me.
Plus and you had a really good point about neural growth. I often hear that as well, like, you know, this magical pill grows new neurons. I'm like, okay, you know, like certain mushroom, I forget. God, can't believe I forgot the mushroom name. It regrows neurons as well. And it's non-psychoactive. It's a lion's mane. And see, I need more lion's mane, right? You know, that's great. But it's like, well, what's filling that space? You know, like what does that mean? You know, you have more neurons. Like, is that good? You know, is that bad? What does that mean? You know, and I don't think that people tend to think about those questions. They're like, oh, I'm going to take this psychedelic and I'm growing. I'm going to have new memories and, you know, I'm going to be smarter. That's generally where we're going at here. You know, we're going to live longer. But in reality, it's like, well, okay, what does that mean? Is that good? Right.
Yeah, people, I think, accidentally assume neural growth means intelligence, right? Or that neural complexity means greater intelligence. It doesn't necessarily mean that. It can help that. I think the important thing is that so all therapies are designed to create strengths where there are weaknesses, right? Or to make up for weaknesses. So if you're having a problem with your brain, like depression or anxiety because of a problem in your connective tissue, being able to, you know, break apart those connections and reconfigure them in a new way and promote some new growth that strengthens the areas that have been deteriorated and maybe, sidelines areas that are causing you problems, that's a good thing. I mean, that's what you want to do for therapy. But if you're doing like a cosmetic therapy where you're like, I'm already smart and I'm already functional, I want to be more smart and more functional, I think that's problem use. I think you're getting into it's like you know, kids in college who take Adderall thinking it's going to make them smarter. It doesn't really make you smarter. It just allows you to stay up longer if you have a lot of studying to do. But, you know, studies have shown that people don't retain that knowledge. It doesn't help you score better on tests. It doesn't have, you may feel smarter while you're on speed because your thoughts are moving faster, but it doesn't actually import any new intelligence.
Right.
Same thing with neural growth. Neural growth, it may allow you to access memories that you might not have thought of in a long time. May bring back up stuff that you've forgotten, because those memory pathways have been atrophied, but they're still there. So you could be in a psychedelic state and reconnect to a memory from childhood that you haven't experienced since the first time you had that memory, and that's a really amazing thing. I think there's a lot of transformation that can happen in that. Also, there could be a lot of trauma that comes out of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Memory that you relive. And I had a problem like that when I was tripping with a friend that I had for a long time since childhood. And while we were tripping, I remembered a lot of really shitty things that he had done to me as a child. And it was tough.
yeah.
It was a tough thing to go through. Oh, you may have scarred me as a child because of some of these things that I haven't even thought about since we were. And it's not always, butterflies and rainbows.
Definitely. Man, I'm going to have to go through the pit myself and really dive back into deep, because it sounds like you are on the forefront of a lot of research that is coming out now. And so I want to find out what's in there to find out what we're going to be learning about in the near future. So
this is great. That's book. Basically, I mean, really the idea about, breaking apart brain modules and having them spontaneously reconfigure, that was kind of a new idea that I was introducing based on research that I had read. This thing about neural growth was something that I just assumed had to be happening because that's the only way behavioral change works. A lot of other stuff in the book is based on research that's already been done. So it's more or less already sound. It doesn't need a whole lot of tweaking. I'm surprised that the stuff that's sort of confirming what I was saying is coming out faster than I thought it would. I think that psychedelic research in general is happening faster now because there's a little bit of a looser attitude toward allowing that research to happen. But I don't really consider myself to be like a genius who knows stuff that other people don't know. I think I just putting this stuff together earlier than a lot of people because, I was paying attention to what was going on in various different fields. People in academia, they really have to specialize on the field that they're in. So they don't get a lot of crossover from other fields. I was studying everything. Whenever a new study would come out in this field, I would study that. When a new study would come out about hallucination, I would study that. So since I'm not in academia and I don't have a specialty, I was just watching a lot of stuff happen all at once. And when I put Pitt out, I thought, well, this is it. This is the closest we're ever going to get to figuring out how this works.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be gained from that.
Yeah, and hopefully, I haven't seen any studies that have come out that have, fundamentally gone against what I said in Pitt. There may be, some tweaking about this and that, how it works, how long it works for. The neuroplasticity is definitely more aggressive than I thought it was in my book. So things like that may happen where it's like I make like really sort of what I think are bold claims about what's going on. And it turns out they may be even more dramatic than what I said. So that's, I didn't think that was going to be happening. I thought, I may be right about this thing or it may sort of be the opposite of that, but similar. A lot of the stuff that I'm seeing is just sort of right on the money. Every time I see a new study, it's like, yeah, that looks right.
Yeah. It's interesting, man. It's interesting how that works.
Yeah.
Well, James, thanks for coming with us or coming to be on our show. Can you give us some websites, some ways to reach you, things like that people can use?
You can find Psychedelic Information Theory at psychedelicinformationtheory.com. And there's an email address there that people can contact me through. If you want to listen to the podcast where I talk about the darker side of psychedelics, that's at dosenation.com. There's also an address there that you can contact me through. I'm also on Twitter. I don't really post a lot on Twitter, but people can contact me on Twitter. A lot of people do contact me through Twitter because they can't find me anywhere else. And that's
awesome, man.
James L. Kent at Twitter. So it's a good way to find me.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Talk about your theory and the research and everything. And I appreciate it, man, because I learned a lot again. I often forget things, maybe more of that neural connection stuff I need. So until next time, bro.
If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo and would like to hear more about James Kent and his work, you can visit our website at taileaters.com/CE podcast. And there you can click on links that will take you to his work as well as his book. Additionally, you can support this podcast through our Patreon page, located at the same website. We look forward to bringing you additional episodes in the near future, but until then, happy dreaming!